Hello, everybody. It is Lee Milt here, and I am your coach for today. And I have a very special celebrity expert. And you probably already know about Jim Palmer, who is known as the newsletter guru because he has been with our coaching program for a very long time. But if you don't, let me tell you a little something about him before I start interviewing him. He is a marketing and business building expert and the host of Newsletter Guru TV and Stick Like Glue Radio. He is known internationally as the Newsletter Guru, as I've said, and the go-to resource for maximizing the profitability of customer relationships. He is the founder and president of Custom Newsletters, Inc., a parent company of the No Hassle Newsletters, No Hassle Social Media, the Newsletter Guru Concierge Print and Mail on Demand, Magnetic Attraction and Retention Training Program, Success Advantage Publishing, Double My Retention, Stick Like Glue Radio, and Newsletter Guru, and more and more and more. He's the author of a whole bunch of books, and we're going to give you his bio on our membership site. But what we're talking about today is his brand new book, and that is called Decide, D-E-C-I-D-E. And the subtitle is The Ultimate Success Trigger. Now, just so you know, Jim is a guy who doesn't just give information. He actually lives it, he breathes it, and he is written a truly a very beneficial book for business owners and entrepreneurs. So welcome to our call, Jim.
Thank you very much, Lee. It's always a pleasure to be with you and your community.
Well, thanks, and we love you in our community because you are kind of the tell-it-like-it-is guy, and, of course, as I have said before, you know, I've interviewed you before, and I've hired you to speak at some of my coaching groups, and you really not only speak from the heart, but you give very wise information. And so when you sent me your book, and I actually wrote a testimonial for your book, I get so many books in the mail each month, and there's only so many I could read. But when yours came in, it got to the top of the pile. And, your book talks a lot about the importance of making fast decisions. So I know the book is called Decide, but tell us why fast decisions are so important for us entrepreneurs.
You know, Lee, one of the things about fast decisions, businesses in general thrive on momentum, right? So it's always about building momentum, and just you can picture the classic snowball going down the hill. The faster it goes, the bigger it gets. It's, you know, it just keeps going. It gets harder to stop. And, you know, you could even scrape by an occasional tree in the forest. It'll take out a chunk, but it just keeps motoring along. The other side of that, the flip side of that, is indecision, right? And so indecision is a drag on business. And what I have figured out just from studying, I mean, some truly amazing people like yourself and Dan Kennedy, you know, Bill Glazer, just some really, you know, hugely successful people, is that they seem to have an uncanny ability to quickly assess an opportunity or a challenge or a decision in some way. They'll deliberate the pros and cons, and then they make a decision. Yes or no, Lee, is good. But what I say is, if you're going to put something on the back burner or decide to think about it, that takes you to a place called Squishyville, which is a place where opportunities go to die. And so the ability to decide is, I think, in large part comes from confidence. And we know that confidence comes from success, and that comes from being in action. So it is all about action, momentum, and moving forward. And the ability to decide is something that keeps you moving forward, and indecision is like tying an anchor around your waist.
Well, what you say in the book, which is very true, and I'm on page 15, is that before success, confidence happens when you first decide that enough is enough. So let's just talk about that, because in your book, of course, the whole book is about decide, but what is enough is enough?
The whole book is about how decisions become, it's just, they're an integral part of our day. I mean, we probably literally make 100 decisions, 200, I don't know, I've never stopped to count, but many, many decisions every day. And so, Lee, one of the things that's different about this book from my other five books, which are talking about strategies and things that you can do to grow your business, implementable things, this book, one of the reasons I'm just so appreciative of your kind words is I was called to write this. I felt led to write this book because my last book came out less than a year ago, and I really wanted to take a break. It was five books in 5 years, Lee. And I said, I got to take a break. But something happened at one of my events, and it was like I started sharing not just some techniques and strategies, but I started opening up about things that I have faced, things that I overcame, and I started resonating. And one of the sessions I taught, Lee, was about a 45-minute session called Success, Money, and Mindset. And so I didn't just, again, talk about, positive mindset, do affirmations. I shared what I went through when I was like well over six figures in debt after unemployment and cancer. And then I started my business and very slow going at first, and how even though I had debt, I kept investing in myself. And I talked about that. And when I did, Lee, I looked out and I saw at least four people with tears in their eyes. And I knew that it wasn't just good information, but I was resonating. And I knew that at that moment, Lee, my story was their story. And a couple people came up to me at the end and said, you have to share this kind of, what you're doing about your sharing your personal life. You have to share this in a much bigger way. And they said, you ought to write a book about that. And I'm like, God darn, I don't want to write another book
not another book.
But I kept hearing it over and over. And so, Lee, I decided to write that book. And one of the reasons this book was so much harder to write than the others, I feel like for a good 60 days I was on my therapist couch just pouring out because, again, there's a lot of sharing. But I want to address your question. Success happens when you decide that enough is enough. And in the book, I talk about a 3 a.m. holy crap moment, which every entrepreneur will face, or maybe you face many of them. And that's when you're laying in bed, it's pitch dark, your eyes are open, you're looking up at the dark ceiling, and you're going, holy crap, how am I going to make payroll this week? Holy crap, I haven't paid myself in 4 months and I own the darn business. Holy crap, when am I going to get a new client? And all these moments. And what I have learned through some good coaching and different books, like your book's one of the first ones I read, Success is an Inside Job. And so when I read books like that, and what happens is most of the time, if you really whittle it down and peel away all the crap, the layers of crap that we surround ourselves with, we as entrepreneurs, we are the impediment to our own growth. And so it's nice to say that. And so what I did in chapter one, Lee, if you remember, I actually named several of the things that I was impeding in my growth. Number one, public speaking. Hated it. Didn't want to do it. You're not going to drag me on stage. Doing videos, running my own live events, all these different things were things that I knew very successful people that were kind of operating in the world that I'm operating in were doing. But I was I was bound and determined to find a way to be successful without doing them until it just became clear, I'm achieving some success, but I really wanted a lot, and I had to have several 3 a.m. moments of holy crap moments where I had to say, Palmer, get out of your own way and man up and start doing this stuff. And you know me, Lee, I have twin girls, and at that time they wanted to go to college. I knew soon after that they'd probably get married, and so I had some serious outflow of cash, and I just knew I had to grow a bigger business faster. And so I became a speaker, and I even share in the book, I'm not sure if you saw this, but one of the first real tests for me after I so-called took the head trash out, did everything I could from Dale Carnegie to joining a monthly program. I went to hypnosis. I did everything, and I actually got over my fear of public speaking. And right about that time is when you and Bill invited me to speak at that first Peak meeting. And I have to tell you, I think there was probably about 90 or 100, very successful entrepreneurs in that room, and it was one of the most defining moments in my getting out of my own way by accepting that speaking gig.
Well, Jim, I remember that clearly because when I asked you, I was so aware, now that you mentioned this, and I could tell you, I was so aware of your reluctance that most people, when I ask them to speak in front of all those people, they're like, oh, yeah, man, I can't wait to be there. And you're like, okay, I can do that. So congrats. And you've come so far since then. And that was about 5 years ago?
Yeah, I think that was like 2009 time frame, and again, that was a thing where my normal reaction would have been, well, I'm traveling, I can't do it, I'm busy. But that was such a defining moment for me. And I did, there's so many things. I practiced like crazy for 3 months because it was like 3 or 4 months in advance. And it was just a defining moment in, first of all, in myself and in my life as an entrepreneur. And I can get on any stage now and speak anywhere. I actually enjoy it. But I mean, it was a major hurdle for me. But that's part of the head trash that goes on. That's part of that reaching that point where you say enough is enough. I'm going to do what I need to do to grow my business.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. All entrepreneurs have those 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. for me personally, wake-up calls of, oh, I need to make this change. I need to do this different thing. And to do that, the demons are really inside of me holding me back. It's not like there isn't, you know, that I can't mail people or I can't, you know, produce a seminar or write a new book or any of those things. It's always the, how do I juggle the 19,000 things I have going now and do this new thing? That seems to be a recurring theme in my life. And I, too, have written a book this year. It's called Reclaim the Magic. So I totally understand about the, I need a break, but that's not going to happen. I do have another question. You used a word a while ago, Squishyville. And I've read your book, every word of the book. But, you know, I know other people don't know what that means. So tell us what and where is Squishyville?
Well, you know, one of the things our great mentor Dan Kennedy says is successful people have their own language, their own terminology, and things like that. So for lack of a better description, it's the back burner. But I thought, well, I can't just talk about the back burner, so I call it Squishyville. Now, when you have a decision to make, what happens is, again, yes or no, and they're both perfectly fine. Not everything is meant to be a yes, but when you say, I'm going to think about it, I think that just takes people, it's like going off the superhighway, you're exiting off this place where everybody just goes to hang out and, gee, how you doing? Oh, I'm good. What do you think? Oh, I don't know. I'm going to talk about that, blah, blah, blah. And nothing ever happens in Squishyville. And, you know, I was talking to a guy who is in the social media field, and I was explaining about, you know, when you make fast decisions, first of all, it's good for your business because you keep momentum, but you also don't miss opportunities. And he said, you're right. He said, a couple years ago, he had an opportunity to create this program in this certain social media platform, and he said, I've come to revisit it, and it turns out that thing which was once hot 2 years ago has now changed. He said, I'm not going to do that. Now, I don't know if it would have been good or not, but that's an example where if you put things on the back burner or into Squishyville, that's where nothing ever happens. And so people sometimes will say, well, you know I should invest in, you know, a coaching program, peak performers or anything else. I know I should do that. I know I should go to seminars. When my business gets to a certain point, I'm going to do that. And that is Squishyville type thinking, because you should know as at a 3 a.m. moment that it is that event, it is that course, it's that coaching, that pushing that will get you to that place. And so we will seldom do it on our own because, Lee, as an entrepreneur, there's nobody that's going to call you down the hall, you know, like when you used to have a boss and say, get to that event or go do this. We are the boss. And so if there's something we don't want to do, for years, if I didn't want to accept a speaking gig, no one's going to call me on the carpet and you know, and tell me that's wrong and force me to go do it. So as entrepreneurs, we are our own worst enemy because so many of us like to live in Squishyville.
Yes, that's extremely true. And also a while ago you were talking about head trash. I think it would be really good for us to talk about why it's important to take out the trash if you really want to accelerate your growth. And of course, you know, I spend my living talking about that, but you know, I always love to hear how other people phrase things. And so I actually like that term head trash because that's, you know, the old saying garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
That it really is true. It is it's false pictures in our mind and references in our mind about what we're capable of. So talk to us about why we need to get rid of that.
Head trash, you know, for anybody who's wondering what head trash is, it is all the stuff, it's the garbage that's floating around in your head that is preventing you from moving forward. You know, from the time we're born, everything that we see, hear, things we've been told, we watch, observe, it's all in there. You know, it's the power of the subconscious mind that we've learned so much about. And your subconscious mind is affecting how you're thinking and what you're doing. And so head trash, whether, again, as a kid, some, you know, God forbid your parents said, you'll never amount to nothing, you know, that type of thing, or anything, even up to current day, where if you're hanging with the wrong people and go, oh, don't do that, don't spend money, I'll just, you know, just wait it out, wait for the next election or whatever it's going to be. But head trash, it's just made up of basically negative, self-limiting thoughts. And just like the head, just like the trash in your kitchen, if you let it sit there too long, it's going to stink up the joint. Now, I share something in this book. When I went to a hypnotist as one of the things to get over public speaking, which let me just do a detour real quick. Lee, I also mentioned when I have a 3 a.m. moment, I don't just try something and see if it works. I go all in. So I mentioned the Dale Carnegie program. I mentioned hypnosis. I went to professional hypnosis. He taught me how to do self-hypnosis, the positive affirmations, all of that stuff. So I didn't want to go and wait 3 months and say, okay, a little bit better, now try something else. I did it all, right? And so when you tackle your head trash, you've got to eliminate a lot of this stuff. And the hypnotist gave me an expression that I still use today, and it's just brilliant. He goes, Jim, it's like you can't just say positive affirmations and expect that to like be the good stuff that layers on top of all the bad stuff and have it grab hold and be successful. He said, if you're going to do positive affirmations and try and change your thinking today, he said, you first have to clean out the crud. And he said, he likened it to if you're a coffee connoisseur and you buy a $100 bag of the ultimate roast of coffee, and then you put it in like a 10-year-old coffee pot, which has got stains and crud in the bottom. He said, you have to clean out the crud first. So you really have to kind of address your fears and you know, see what's going on, and then take out the trash and then move forward. That's how you're going to really make some positive change with your mindset.
Well, Jim, I'm very impressed that you, when you decide and you have those, you know, 3M moments that you're going to go full steam ahead, and the fact that you went to, you know, someone who would help you in all of those places. There seems to be sometimes, I don't know if it's ego involved or people are afraid to admit they have a problem and they are in denial a great deal that they don't need help, and they often try to do things themselves instead of getting another professional to help them, a coach or hypnosis or, you know, Dale Carnegie or whatever thing. So really, congratulations. That's actually a very big deal. In our culture, women are seen as people often who are willing to do whatever it takes, you know, to move to the next level, and men have been very, very programmed to feel, well, I should be able to shoulder this on myself. So it's very refreshing that you share that, because that will be very impactful for a lot of the people listening today. In one of your chapters, it's all about the need to be perfect. So how can we slow down progress? What do you mean by good is good enough?
Well, perfection is the enemy of progress, and for a lot of folks who become entrepreneurs, unlike the rare few who just kind of grow up that way and just take off, but most people end up working for, you know, a company or, you know, corporate world or something like that. And in that kind of environment, unfortunately, if you make a mistake, if you miss a comma on a 200-word document, you know, you get called on the carpet, and, you know, so you're afraid to do anything without a lot of people signing off on it. But in the world of entrepreneurs, you know, it is the ability to move forward faster, and you do have the ultimate say. And so perfection is the enemy of progress. And so one of the things that, again, we learned, I certainly quote Dan Kennedy a lot. To be honest, he's the biggest influence in my entrepreneurial journey, as I know he is in yours. But, you know, that's where I first heard about good is good enough. And, you know, it was at a, I believe it was at a super conference, and I think it was Bill Glazer who was actually talking about this, and this was, Lee, this was the 2008-2009 time frame, and I had written my first book called The Magic of Newsletter Marketing. It took me almost a year and a half to write it, and I just couldn't get myself to pull the trigger, because guess what? My name was on the cover. God forbid there's a mistake. I didn't find the last example where I said S-O-N instead of S-U-N, and, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and I was, every spare moment I had, I'm trying to find all the mistakes mistakes, because if I'm going to be a published author, doggone it, I want this book to be perfect, you know? And so I'm learning about good is good enough, and I just think it was a blessing in my life that he likened it to being an author. And he said it this way. He said, now, if somebody goes in Barnes & Noble and they see your book on the shelf, you know, attractive cover, good title, maybe they buy the book. He said, you at least sold a book, and if the book's good and they read it, maybe you'll get a client. But he said, if that book is still in your word processor because you're looking for the very last spelling or grammar mistake, first of all, you're not making a sale, and you're not helping the people with your information. And being a man of action, my book was out 3 weeks after that super conference in 2009. And so that's an example. Now, people struggle with this good is good enough. Well, does it mean I can put out crappy work? Absolutely not. It does not give you license to put out shoddy or careless work. You want to put out your best work and then pull the trigger. You don't seek to be perfect, because there really is no perfect. And again, if you strive for that, that will slow your progress down. And so I'm going to give you a little bit of a mindset tweak that I think can help people, because they really struggle. And so what you want to do is choose to be judged on the value of the content and the value that you're creating. Lee, I fully know that when I launched this book, I wrote Decide in 60 days. I do have an editor. We both proofread it at least 30 times, but we pulled the trigger. And sure enough, you know, I have found mistakes. I've had people point out mistakes. That's a cool thing. People should. Oh, and they'll take.
We're very familiar with that.
They'll take yes. great glee. Oh, Jim.
Yes.
You know what? And it's so. What I did, I'm okay with that. I said, well, thank you very much. I'll change that in the next printing. And I remember in my second book, Stick Like Glue, a friend of mine came back, and I shared it with – I was so proud. I'm on the cover officially. That was the first book I put myself on the cover. And he wasn't even a business guy, just a friend. He said, oh, that's really cool, man. Look at you. You're an author, all this and that. And then a couple weeks after that, he comes back. We somehow were together for some reason. He goes, Jim, just do you have an editor? I'm like, well, yeah.
Oh, geez.
I found a bunch of stuff, and there was even a few dangling participles. And I'm like, well, first of all, I don't even know what a dangling participle is. I'm good Lord.
I don't either.
And I said, did you learn anything that could help you in your business? And he goes, yeah, there's a couple good things. I said, good. That's the only way I choose to be judged. Now, it goes to what you just mentioned about ego, right, Lee? So I never went to journalism or writing school. I never went to learn how to be a speaker. I happen to think I've got some smarts when it comes to marketing. And this is the information that I want to share. And I choose to be judged on that information and not the fact that, I'm not a trained author. I just happen to write books to share the information that I want to help entrepreneurs with.
Well, I like that a lot. Choose to be judged on value, because you know that I used to do public seminars for 6 straight years, and no matter what workbook I put out, there was going to be a ton of mistakes on it, because I didn't go to any other schools either, and I have no idea what a dangling part of, you know, all that stuff is. And that's why I have great editors. And every book I've ever done, every workbook I've ever done, even if we edit it 30 times, there'll be a mistake in it. And I mean like a spelling mistake. And every author that I know, Jim, has also said to me, you know, we do our best, and, you know, it's just, you know, there's no such thing as a book being absolutely perfect, that, you know, unless it's some textbook that's been over 100 times by very anal people. But the chances of people reading that are slim to none. And the other good thing about you not going to those schools is that you are very authentic. You speak from your heart. And you also write to us, meaning entrepreneurs and business owners. And we have a wider view of we're looking for value. By the truth is, most of us are skimming the book. We're looking for gems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're really looking for what is it I don't know that I want to really, you know, really read. I won't say his name, but I've interviewed a particular author who is fantastic. He's a great speaker, but I have never seen so many mistakes in one book in my entire life, and I just laugh at them, because the information is so valuable that you just overlook the misspellings, because it's like he writes it and nobody edits it. It just gets published, because he's published like 25 books.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think it's very good that you give this kind of information. And I just used the term authentic self, and I know that you write about this and that how we should all be more authentic. Share what you mean by that.
You know, and I'm going to call it the olden days. So I know you'll probably remember a show called Leave It to Beaver, right? So you remember when Ward went off to work with his suit and his hat and his briefcase, and he had his work friends, and then he came home on the weekends and put on the silly bowling shirt that you see so much on Two and a Half Men today. But you know, that was the personal Ward, and seldom did the two worlds collide. Well, today with this ever connected planet we live on, thanks to the internet and with social media specifically, it is impossible to have what I deem a personal brand and a professional brand. And so people are going to learn about you. They're going to find out about you. One of the examples I give in the book is, let's say you're a young couple and you have a new kid, and you both want to continue working, so you're going to hire a nanny. You whittle it down to two people. You bring them in the home for an interview. They both do really well, got good resumes, and then they leave, and then you say, honey, how do we decide? I don't know. So you Google them, or up comes Facebook, and you see some pictures of drinking parties and things like that. Now, again, I'm not judging anybody. I'm not, you know, it's not our role to be judgmental, but I'm going to tell you that will come into, is going to have an impact on who you hire to take care of your kid. And, you know, the other way I talk about how this affects you is, you know, in the last few years, I just think the general discussion that we have in this country has gotten so, the discourse is just so rah, rah. You know, people choose sides and they just scream at each other. And, you know, I think of, if you think of when movie stars or rock stars somehow in the last 10 years started sharing their opinions about stuff. And there's a couple. I'll tell you one, John Cougar. I probably got every CD and album he ever had, John Mellencamp. And then when he started mouthing off about the war and stuff, I took offense, not offense, but it turned my feelings a little bit. I'm not saying I stopped buying his stuff, but it will taint your impression if you start sharing too much of your personal self in your business world. And so that can be detrimental. Now, so, well, Jim, how is that being authentic if you don't share your stuff? Well, what I do, and the reason I'm on Facebook and other social media platforms, I choose to be my authentic self. You know, I love to laugh. I love casual clothes. I love helping entrepreneurs. People know I'm just in love with my grandson, and I got my boat, and they know things about me that help them get to know me as a person. But I don't talk about my politics or, you know, all this other sex, drugs, religion, all this other hot button topics, because, you know, I personally, I don't want to take the chance on offending people that could be potential clients. I mean, Lee, there are people in my coaching program now. I know that I probably not hang out with them on a personal level, but we have a great professional relationship. I am my authentic self. I don't shy away from, you know, for example, being a Christian, but I don't wear it on my sleeve, if you know what I mean. And so I think you got to choose what you're going to share, and you want to share enough because people will find it. So this is kind of the second part of this, kind of a probably a little bit more of a complex chapter in the book, but you want to take note of what you're talking about, maybe the causes that you're championing and things like that, because you don't, when I market or when I share, when I do my videos, I am my authentic self, but there's a filter that is there, and it's like, first of all, would my grandmother approve of this, you know, maybe something like that, and or, you know, is this going to help people get to know me, like me, and trust me enough to do business? Because if it wasn't for my business, I seriously doubt I'd be on Facebook or anything like that. So I did learn the value of being authentically when I started doing videos, and because you can't hide who you are, you know, behind the written word or the blog or the article or the book. When you're doing videos, people see everything, right? You do some great videos, but you can't hide who you are if you're going to be out there in front of the camera all the time. So, you know, you just got to be your authentic self, but you also don't want to be sharing, hey, let me show you the scar from my surgery when I was a kid, you know, stuff like that. That was probably a silly example, but there's so much personal information you don't need to be sharing with your audience.
Well, I follow you on Facebook, and you definitely love your grandkids, and you definitely love casual clothes, and all the pictures of, there was a picture of you asleep the other day with your grandson, you know, leaning on you, and it was absolutely adorable, and I agree with you 100%. There is not a need to aggravate and excite people unnecessarily about our own personal views of sex and religion and you know, certain things. And so I don't talk about politics. I don't talk about those things because the people who do tend to attract the haters. And it, you know, life is already complicated enough. Why bring that upon yourself? And so I'm all about showing the authentic self of, you know, the good part of yourself, but, you know, we don't need to share things that are, aren't necessary for sure. You also talk in your book about the importance, which I really believe in, is being immune to criticism. And a lot of people have a hard time with that. I mean, one of my favorite books is called The Four Agreements, and one of the four agreements is don't take anything personally. And yet, almost every day I have to remind myself when certain things happen of, like, don't take that personally because it feels personal. So tell us some of your secrets of how to be immune to criticism. Because, you know, we're out there. Whenever you speak, whenever you blog, whenever you're on social media, whenever you write books, whenever you, you know, do anything like that, you people feel the right that you're a public figure to give you their opinion.
If you are going to be a highly successful entrepreneur, I don't know many places you can do that without having a high public profile, if you will, right? I mean, I guess there's some day traders and guys that hide in their basement and trade stocks. That's different. But if, for the most part, if you're a speaker, coach, entrepreneur, you've got to have a high platform. And, you know, I don't know if Dan originally said it, but, you know, the higher up the flagpole you go, the more your butt's going to hang out. And I have a comma. I added to that, by the way. I said, it's okay because the view is better up there. And
that's true.
So, but the bottom line is criticism is everywhere. And when I started doing videos, I'll never forget when we adopted Toby almost 5 years ago. He's our dog, our beagle, Basset. And so he started getting in the videos with me. And somebody took me to task in an email that must have taken him half an hour to write about the value of dogs. They've got their own integrity, and you're using it as a prop. Toby's a prop. Really? I mean, like, seriously? Really? Oh, my God. And, you know, I'm like, good Lord, first of all, get a life, because, you know, it's ridiculous. I love Toby, and he's just a part of my life, and therefore I'm going to show him. And by the way,
exactly,
people love dogs, and they connect with me because I show them. But anyway, you know, the thing is, you will be criticized no matter what you're going to do. And the fact of the matter is, the only people, Lee, who aren't being criticized are those people who aren't doing anything. And so what I have developed over the years is kind of this two-step filter. So the two-step filter is the person who's giving me criticism or feedback somebody that I know and trust? In other words, do they have a reputation for having a good understanding of whatever it is that I'm putting out there? So, for example, suppose somebody says, Jim, I don't like the cover of your book. It's very dark and, you know, blah, 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 whatever, right? And I would say, well, are you an author? Did you write books? How many books have you sold? Blah, blah. So that would be an inference. And the other part of the filter is it's somebody who whose opinion, because I may not know the person, but, you know, there may be somebody who's got a wealth of knowledge and expertise in this area, and if they shared something with me, even though I don't know them, I might want to look at that. And but I will tell you this, that two-stage filter has served me well, and the one thing it does is the amount of people that are going to criticize you don't fall into any of those categories. It's the people who are just going out there and just spewing venom, and a lot of it stems, I think, from jealousy or envy or things like that. You know, because if you're around the right kind of people, you should be around people who are lifting you up and supporting you, encouraging you, and championing you, and making you, you know, reach for bigger things. So criticism is everywhere. The final part of that, Lee, is, you know, there's criticism that will come to you, but then there's criticism that you can invite. So one of the things you don't want to do as an entrepreneur is ask somebody for some feedback who hasn't earned the right to do that. And by the way, that could be a good friend or a spouse or a neighbor or something like that. Like, I obviously love my spouse, but I love my neighbors. There's some good friends I have, but I'm not necessarily going to ask them about something in my business. First of all, if they're not a business owner or they don't have any expertise or experience in that area, just because I want to get feedback. In other words, you want to get your okayness met by people who really can add value to it. Because one of the things that's very harmful to the growth of your business is when people that you do know and like and trust, even if they're not qualified, if you understand the distinction there, if they it's like they're popping a hole in your balloon. So if you're like, hey, look at this, isn't this great? And they go, I don't get it, I don't like it. And all of a sudden you can hear the air squeak. popping out of your balloon, and that balloon represents your ego or your self-confidence. So you got to be careful who you ask for opinions, first of all, and then if the opinions come flying over the transom, so to speak, run them through the filter. Is this somebody who I already know and like and trust and knows me, and or is this somebody who's actually got some experience in is sharing some real-world helpful advice?
And to add to that, I think a lot of people have this attitude, if you ask them a question, that they look for what's wrong. You know, like if you go to a doctor, they're looking for what's wrong. And I find this with surveys. You see events, and you go to an event, and you've had a great time at the event, and then they send you this survey about how was the parking, how was the food, and then suddenly your mind actually goes up to look for what was wrong. And my opinion about doing surveys for businesses has changed dramatically since, you know, I've gotten some interesting feedback about I had a good time until I filled out the survey and started thinking about what could go wrong. So I'm all on board with everything you just said there, and I love the two-filter process. That's extremely good.
let me put a bow on it with this. If you want to be a very successful entrepreneur, language I use is, if you want to grow a dream business, you simply do not need the approval from others, all right? You need to develop a thick skin, know that what you're doing is right, and keep charging ahead, naysayers be damned.
I that's a great bow, and I think everybody in our world, especially business owners, you know, there are people who just are nuts. To be honest with you, they're just nuts. They defy gravity. They're impossible. They're not rational. I see them occasionally when we travel, just very outrageous people. Nothing can appease them. So you just really want to stay away from those people. And those are people you should fire from your list whenever possible. Moving on, because we only have about 10 minutes left, but in your chapter called Delegation, you say, you either delegate or you stay small. So I'm a big believer in delegation. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, and after I wrote the chapter, I could have wrote this whole chapter in delegate or die, you know, because
right.
The fact of the matter is, again, we all come from usually a corporate background. Maybe there's a nice support team involved. But then when you go to become an entrepreneur, in the early days, it is us. I mean, nobody that I'm aware – well, I'm sure there's some companies with public funding or whatever, or you know. But most people start, you know, at the kitchen table, dining room, spare bedroom, or basement office. And so whatever course, skill or talent that you have. So for me, you know, 14 years ago, I was going to help companies with newsletter marketing. So that's my core skill. Now, obviously, being brand new and starting at zero, I didn't hire an accountant. I didn't hire, you know, somebody to clean my office. I didn't hire all the other roles that need to take place to have a good business. But there does come to be a point, Lee, and it's different for different people. Whenever that traction gets hold, there's a point where all, because you keep focusing, hopefully you're focusing on high revenue generating activities, you know, delivering the, talking with your clients, marketing your business, that some of these other things which are important are going to start slipping away. And so a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, have that expression, I can do it cheaper, faster, and better than someone else. And so in the book I say, let me take a little license here. I can do it cheaper, faster, and better than anyone else, and I'll be darned if I'm going to pay someone else to do something I can do myself. I want all the money I want in my pocket. I'm not going to hire anybody. I don't want any support staff, period. And that's how a lot of people think about it. When what I've learned, thanks to you know, some good coaching, and actually the very first mastermind I joined, is when I first heard the term virtual assistant, you don't have to actually hire staff with, you know, payroll and benefits and all this and that. You may choose to do that, but there's a lot of things you can hire out through virtual assistants, so it's kind of like 1099 contract work. And so what do? Well, you start looking for tasks that are taking up your time, because if you're doing task-oriented work that someone could do for you for anywhere from, you know, $10 an hour to $50 or $100, whatever it is, that is work that you should be delegating. You know, the example is, if you want to earn $1 million, you should be doing work that's worth $400 an hour. So if you're doing $10 an hour work, you're never going to earn $400. So you do have to release and let go. And that is a very hard thing for entrepreneurs for two reasons. They're control freaks. They want to be in charge and kind of what I call put their entrepreneurial stink on everything. And then the other reason is ego. They want to be in charge of their entire domain. They want everything to be theirs. So they get all the credit. And to me, I have a team of 10 people that help me with my various businesses, and I love dishing out the credit. It's not about ego for me. It's about building my business. There's no doubt I help support some other folks in their endeavors, but I'm building a bigger business because I no longer feel that I need to do everything. So what I do is I focus on marketing my business, doing interviews like this, writing books, going to events, speaking, and then, you know, probably the other major part of my business is working with my coaching clients. All the other stuff, even the newsletters today, No House Newsletters, I put writers and designers in place that do things my way. I've set up the systems and procedures, and things get done. So one last thing, and I know my answers are long, but let me give you one last thing on the systems and procedures. What you want to do as an entrepreneur is always have your eyes 5 years down the road. So whether that's 5 years down the road is going to lead to more growth, or 5 years down the road might mean to selling out or cashing out and sitting on the beach or sitting on your boat, whatever that looks like. But the businesses that are going to sell for the most have a couple things going. They have a good customer base, a good customer list. They have recurring revenue, good revenue stream, but they also have the systems and procedures in place so that when you check out on a Friday afternoon and get your check, the guy who bought your business shows up Monday morning and things still run. So if everything's in your head, you know all the different moving pieces. If that's how you're operating today, not only are you shortchanging your growth, but you are shortchanging your ability to sell that business someday.
That is absolutely true, everything you said. Okay. Before we leave you today, you wrote about the imposter syndrome. So how does that affect new entrepreneurs?
It's so brutal. And, you know, it's actually gotten a little easier. When I started my business, say, 14 years ago, having a home-based office wasn't – I mean, it was getting more common, but it still wasn't quite commonplace. So when I would meet with a prospective client, of course, I'd put on my, my one and only suit, and I'd have my business cards. I opted for the shiny gloss. I'd have some brochures and stuff. And I would usually go meet with them, right, in their office, or we'd meet at a restaurant or something, but obviously never in my house. And so one of the things that I always feared, to be honest with you, is that I was going to be found out, and that's the imposter syndrome. They're going to find out who I really am. Because we go out there talking a big game, and, you know, nobody ever asked me, Lee, and all the customers I've ever gotten, no one's ever asked me, how long have you been in business? They always ask me, how long have you been doing newsletters, to which I could say, truthfully, for over 20 years, which was a good thing. They didn't say, oh, well, when did you start your business? That never happened. And so the imposter syndrome, just boiled down, it really has to do with this feeling like you're going to be found out. And again, what you need to do is reframe the fact that if you do operate out of a home office, a solopreneur, the fact that you're not spending $1,000 or $5,000 on an office and staff, if you don't need it, that doesn't make you a loser. It makes you smart, you know? And I think so you need to, again, what you want to do is reframe your mind to focus on the value that you're creating. And so it has nothing to do with whether you have a home-based office or you have a laptop at your kitchen table. If you provide a service or some kind of a product, some value, and it's really helping make your client's life better, faster, more profitable, whatever, that's what you focus on. So real quick, I'll tell you one quick story that actually happened to me. So when I started bumping up my prices and, you know, I started gaining a little traction, getting a little confidence, and I don't remember the exact price, but let's say I wanted to charge $2,000 to design a newsletter for a company. And Lee, you know, with all my experience, I could probably pull that thing off in about an hour and it would be killer, right? So so you do it for 20 years, you know all the ins and outs. And so if I'm thinking, well, how do I charge $20 for something that just took me an hour? And what if they find out it only took me an hour? That's some serious head trash, imposter type thinking. So what you want to do is reframe it so that you're focused again on the value that you're providing. So there's two stages of value in my world. So number one, if if they didn't hire me and pay me $2,000 to do their newsletter and instead had to do it themselves, it would probably take them a week, 2 weeks, or a month to do it. They'd have to hire designers and writers and editors and put the whole thing together, so it's a big mess, and I know that for a fact because that's why people come to my programs now. But the other thing is that's focusing on the immediate value, but the big value is if my newsletter, if that, the newsletter that I put out for these people actually brings in more repeat business, more revenue, more new clients, more referrals, that $2,000 potentially could translate to $20,000 in new revenue. So isn't that a bargain? So if you're feeling like you're only a solopreneur and you don't have a lot going on, you're just operating out of your house, that is hogwash thinking. You got to think about the value that you're providing and be rewarded handsomely for the value that you're creating.
Hallelujah. Absolutely. you know, I've been doing Millionaire Smarts now for over 13 years, and every once in a while a sponsor will leave and say to me, oh, I've loved your program, it's been really fantastic, but we're going to do it in-house. I can almost count within 90 days how fast they come back, because it is so hard to do it in-house, you know, to schedule the interviews, get all the reports, get the, you know, membership site up, and, you know, all the faculty and, you know, all the bells and whistles that we do, because we have, you know, this well-oiled machine at Lee Miltier, Inc., and, you know, the people there all know their stuff, and they have their parts in the machinery, and it goes very fast, and it takes us almost a month to do it. So people who are trying to do this on their own, it will take them 3 months to get out one issue or longer. So I totally understand about the value. And when they come back, they're always apologetic, which is, you know, it's kind of nice. But they, you know, saying, well, you know, I didn't really realize. And I'm sure you've had people drop out of your coaching program and with excuses of, I really need to implement the things you've taught me.
Right.
And you're like, uh-huh, well, you really need to stay in the coaching program so you continue to get appropriate ideas and feedback. But I do have one last question.
Okay.
In your book, you say wealth rewards risk and speed. So tell us how that is true.
You know, again, it always comes down to momentum, and wealth rewards speed. So the faster you get stuff done, the more you do, the faster you put it out there, the more likely you are to be growing a growing profitable business. But wealth also rewards risk. And so I created some more language, unlike Squishyville here. But so I said, let's, you know, if you look at financial risk, one would be like a savings account. So let's say you're a savings account entrepreneur. This is somebody who's okay putting $1,000 in the savings and loan down at the corner in their town, and that money will be there 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. In fact, even if the bank goes bust, it's protected by the government. You'll always have your $1,000. But the reward that you're going to get for putting it in such a safe place is probably 0.5%. You know, it's a whopping half of 1%, if that, right? And
right.
The next risk level, Lee, is what I call a stock market entrepreneur. So a stock market entrepreneur knows, with a little bit of intelligence, I can risk a little bit more money playing the stock market. And even today with interest rates down, you could probably earn 5%. There's people earning 7-8% right now without a great deal of risk. But, you know, if the whole world goes kaflooey, you could potentially lose that principal, but that's the way it goes, right? And then the third example is called a casino entrepreneur, and that's somebody who's willing to roll the dice. It's a much bigger risk, but if it hits, the reward is also bigger. The example I give in my book is Fred Smith, who started Federal Express in the late 70s. Now, he didn't start with one used Cessna plane delivering packages to the state of Kentucky or Tennessee. He invested in multiple DC-9 jets, and for months, if not the first few years, was flying these jets with pilots aboard, sometimes with 10 overnight FedEx letters, losing millions of dollars until he built enough momentum and just the word of mouth spread and it just caught fire. It's a very successful business. What I'm saying, if you really want to grow a big profitable business, you need to be move at least into becoming what I call a stock market entrepreneur and actually a casino. So what does that look like in real terms? One of the examples I share is in 2008. 2008 timeframe, I think, was when I had an opportunity to join my first mastermind. It was $400 a month, and Lee, I did not have it based on cash flow. I was still paying down debt, so if my accountant was to make the decision, he'd say, no way you can do this. But I knew if I was to go in this mastermind, I would, with my work ethic and desire to grow and you know, a few holy crap 3 a.m. moments, I would take the knowledge and everything, all the benefits of masterminding and grow. And sure enough, in about 6 months, I was bringing in more revenue than the $400 outlay. The next time I really had to put on the big boy casino roll the dice pants was when I had an opportunity to exhibit at my first function with Glaser Kennedy. And, you know, the booth space was significant. I don't know what it is at the time or what it is now, but it was $5,000 for the booth space. I had to create a booth. There's travel, hotel. It was a $7,500 investment. Again, at a point in my life financially where the accountant would have said, don't do that. But to me, I wanted to roll the dice because I knew, Lee, that I had something that was of a immense value. I knew there was going to be the perfect crowd, the perfect audience, the number of prospects I'd meet, and I rolled the dice, and boom, I invested in my business, and because I did it, I made the decision in a quick way. I went out there and did it. I certainly risked $7,500, but my business has grown dramatically because I was willing to invest, and, you know, investment equals risk. If you're going to play a small game, if you're a savings account entrepreneur who's saying, I'm going to grow my business based on cash flow alone, and so if I make a sale, I'll take part of that sale and reinvest in the business, and marketing will keep going that way. It's not to say you can't do it, but you're going to be growing your business for years, if not decades, instead of really, you know, figuring out the right ways, the right systems, the right marketing, and opening up the spigot in a big way.
And you know, Jim, coaching, if what I'm hearing you correctly, coaching was the magic pill that actually gave you the motivation and the tools to do that, right?
Coaching and masterminding, without a doubt. I mean, and there, you could say they're one and the same. They're actually a little different. I mean, there's mastermind groups where you're meeting with all your peers. And again, you could learn some great things from your peers. I like to be in a situation where you're also getting coaching from somebody who you're investing in. In other words, they have your permission by way of you, they're paying you money. They can get in your face and really hold you accountable and kind of scold you a little bit and show you where you're coming up short. That is really the, in my opinion, one of the ultimate examples of putting your money where your mouth is, and because there's no doubt, you know, Lee, when I started doing my own live events just last year, but for at least the last 2 or 3 years, several of my peers are like, man, how come you're not doing your own events? You got to do, oh, I'm very busy. You know, I make every excuse in the world. And the truth of it is, Lee, the head trash is like, well, what if I do that and it's not a success? What if I, you know, you got to guarantee the not only the rent a room, you got to guarantee a number of rooms will be rented and the caterer, and you got all this stuff. And what if nobody comes? And the other side of it is, what if I'm very successful and a lot of people come and I stink? You know, that's the head trash. But if you're going to grow a big business, man, you got to kick the head trash to the curb. Have somebody in your corner that's pushing you in a big way to get out there and play a bigger game, and then you got to go for it.
Absolutely. Okay, tell our people who are chomping at the bit to have your book right now how they can get the book.
They can get the book at decideforsuccessbook.com, decideforsuccessbook.com. And, Lee, they can get an actual hard copy book in the mail for $6.95. So I'm giving the book for free. All I'm asking is that they pay for $6.95 for shipping and handling. There's also an audiobook. It's the first book I did a full recording of, and you'll see an opportunity to get that if you like listening to the books as well. The cool thing about the audio is not only did I read, obviously, the written book, but I found myself going off script, sharing stuff that didn't go in the book just because of the way a little voice in my head rolls. So decideforsuccessbook.com, and you can get that for $6.95. And if you want, you can get the audio version as well.
And not only do I recommend that you do that, but I also, for anybody who gets the book, I think you should really study the marketing strategy that Jim has used to market his book, the free offers inside of the book, how he's used praise, how in, like, I'm leaping through the book right now. You even have a page, it's decide and save $100. You talk about your different businesses and bonus offers. So if people would invest in this book, they would not only get great information about, you know, getting rid of the head trash and being your authentic self and, you know, taking action, but they would also get a really great example of literally how you should market yourself with absolute pride. So, Jim, as always, you rock. Here's a standing ovation for you. How about that? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lee. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be with you.
It's always an honor and pleasure to be with you. And for everybody else out there, thank you so much. Please make sure you go to the membership site, and we'll have some excerpts from Jim's book, and we'll also have his bio and all of his information, and particularly how to get the book for free by just paying shipping and handling. So we're going to call it a wrap. Thank you very much. See you next month.